Welcome to What's Left, a weekly political discussion challenging the mainstream left. I'm Eduardo Barca with co-host, teacher and socialist, Andy Lipson, and community organizer and socialist, Kenny Cepeda. We are online at what-s-left.webno.com. Today we will be discussing sort of a mismatch of summer political events, topics, headlines, things that have stood out for us during the summer of 2020. This year has been one of the most eventful or more pivotal times, at least in our, I think, the three of us in our lifetime, and most certainly in history, given that this is the year of the pandemic, this is the year of elections at the same time, and so many populist movements that we have covered from 2019, the results of the aftermath of that, and explosions, etc. So I think we have a lot to share with one another. This will be more of a casual, improvised conversation, and I'm excited to hear what both of you have to say or what your thoughts on this. Before we do that, though, I was wondering if we could just check in with one another. We've had conversations that have been very heavy. We have delved into online distance learning, a series of online distance learning episodes, discussing the Fourth Industrial Revolution with Alison McDowell, John Kleissig, and Tracy Burt and Steven Santos Rico, and with the three of us just discussing reflections, and AJ and Andy talking about, as well as Kenny, actually, both the three of you have actually discussed what should the working class should be, what should be the response from the working class to this wave of the new tech world in education and really in all of our lives, really, because it's going to permeate in every single one of the fabric of society. Mm-hmm. So why don't we start off just checking in before we go into the events of summer 2020. Anyone want to share?
Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, I've been very busy, you know, because of COVID. My community work has taken a lot of time, and you know, I kept up with a lot of the news, you know, casually. I haven't really delved into it, you know, because again of the new normal, I guess, or the new temporary normal, as you know, someone in the last episode said. So I think by and large, like, I might be representative of what a lot of people are going through. You know, we're so busy trying to stay afloat, you know, changes. And that I think that a lot of what the connection of world events gets lost. And I guess that's kind of my goal here, to kind of talk about these things that seem like disconnected on the surface, but at least in my worldview, my frame of analysis, they very much have to do one with the other. And, you know, I was talking to Lipson previous to this, and basically, I mean, there is struggles everywhere, you know, and, or at least reactions, because there's very little organization, but people are fed up in many different ways. But the funny thing to me is that we talked about this stuff previous to COVID. We talked about South America, Europe, you know, Hong Kong obviously has had, you know, their own battles. And so this is not new, but it has captured our attention because it finally got to us. You know, it's finally in our face, you know, but it takes the shape of identity politics and racial politics. And we'll dive into that a little more later, but that's how I think this summer has kind of affected me, you know, a little, and I'm curious to see, you know, put the full picture together, or attempt to, I guess. But I mean, that also goes to show there are ways to, you know, still kind of interact. And at least I think, you know, I think that a lot of us automatically assume that, you know, there's no other way. Everyone stay in your houses and, you know, just say what the experts say. Just follow what the experts say. Even though in my experience, there's been another part of me. My family and myself, we've gone through COVID, you know, the dealing with COVID, not just, you know, people in my family infected, but also dealing with the system and how little they know, and how really negligent they are if this thing is as serious as they think it is. So I'm hoping to dive into that at some point too, because I've had firsthand experience at, you know, the facade of this, at least from my perspective. And I guess it might be biased, but, you know, I try to follow the evidence, and the evidence signals that, you know, there's a lot of people making money, but, you know, it's a facade of protection.
Well, first off, you might be hearing the dog in the background. We got a dog kind of close to the summer. His name is Kizmo, and that's very good news. It's like he looks like a poodle, but he's actually 26% Chihuahua, 24% poodle, 23% Pomeranian, and 24% Australian cattle dog. So he's a real mix. So there's a third person in our family here with Brandy, and so that is a very good news for me, and it's been really nice, even though we're going to be hearing dog barks in episodes in the future. The other thing has just been, you know, it's just like this summer has been another red pill. You know, we did a red pill episode, Eduardo, you and I, but to get into this world of data mining, fourth industrial revolution, biometric surveillance, and all this stuff, it's like the Matrix, you know. And I do believe this stuff is like what's happening to us, not just in terms of the surveillance, but the level of information that's being extracted from us and being used ultimately against us. It's chilling. And I always think that I've figured out how effed up capitalism is, and it continues to surprise me in new ways to scare me and anger me. And that's been difficult to go into that, because actually even some of my socialist friends and allies, you know, feel like I'm walking down into a libertarian direction, which I might. I mean, in terms of, it's more libertarians and people like that who look into this kind of stuff. I'm still a socialist, still a Marxist, but I think what they've uncovered is something that's important to understand. And I think socialists have largely been saying, keep us safe from COVID, and pleading to the state, acting like they're making a demand to the state. But anyway, I shouldn't get into it, but it's a little isolating. It's been a little isolating. So these episodes and getting together with y'all has been pretty important. And I have, having AJ on our episode was important, and reaching out to some colleagues, because I think this is going to be a very depressing year for me as a teacher. I don't see much fight back happening. In fact, again, I see teachers rolling over to the state, to our bosses. I don't see any strikes on the horizon. We're not going to participate in one, as far as I can tell, in San Francisco. If that changes, it's going to be scary, but I'm going to be happy. That's what needs to happen. Right now it's an isolating time, and like AJ, I'm starting school next week with my classes, 100% distance learning, all like this, 26, 27, maybe 30 students per class. And I just feel like it's going to be kind of soul killing to go through a regiment of Zoom, 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 and to see what we're putting our students through, to see what we're putting ourselves through, in the name of what they say is about COVID, but I do think it's about getting rid of public education as we know it, and getting rid of the physical buildings, getting rid of teachers, and replacing us with AI ultimately, and data mining everyone. That is a depressing prospect, and I don't see any fight back on the near horizon. So it's hard. It's going to be hard. But I do appreciate having this forum to kind of talk about things, and talk to both of you, Kenny and Eduardo. You're my friends, and I'm glad to go through, well, not glad to go through it, but I'm glad we're going through this together.
Well, I guess the only thing I have to share is I got COVID-19. I'm positive, so let's carry on with the episode.
You're not going to say anything else? How are you feeling?
I mean, that was the biggest thing that happened to me, you know, for July. I didn't realize.
When did you get diagnosed or whatever?
Jesus, it seems like I had taken more precautions than both of you, or at least I want to say like when we started talking about COVID-19, I think I was more like, you two need to make sure we have very you take this seriously, you know. I would tell you both.
I'm staying away from you. See, that's why.
If our audience looks back at episodes where Kenny and I and Andy speak about COVID-19, I think I was more just worried that we weren't being conspiracists, but I was just wanting to stay to the facts. I was very cautionary with both of you, but look who got it. So I guess I'll just start from spring. The spring just was chaotic, and I had to start helping my brother with just homeschooling, and I did that for June and mid-March and June, and he started reading at May at 5 years old, so had that goal for this time. And then I did big projects out in the yard, worked around the house. There was a lot of things that we were just neglecting, siding of the walls and stuff, and the garden and stuff. But yes, early July was what the medics think that most likely was when I was exposed to the virus somehow, some way. And I did take precautions. I did my best, but you see, look, it can happen to anyone. And I started feeling sort of headaches. They were very mild though. And then I got tested. I asked because they were becoming widely available and there were a number of cases that were rising in California. So I thought, all right, well, why not? Does it matter, right? I mean, I could, now that there are plenty of tests that you can take, I thought, why not? There are testing sites, community-based testing sites. But my healthcare provider said, well, just do it here. And the 23rd of July. So at the time that the test was conducted, the 23rd of July is when I tested positive. And just last week on Friday, I was called. So about a bit over 2 weeks is when I got my results, which is unfortunate because, I mean, I still took it as if I had it. You know, everyone's supposed to pretend like you have it, even if you probably don't, just so that you can be careful because some people can be asymptomatic. And yeah, so I had it on Friday. And that was, that's been sort of a little hard to deal with in the sense that I think people are stigmatizing me, thinking that I still have it and they don't want to be around me, even if we're 2 meters apart. Which is completely understandable, right? I mean, I wouldn't want to put anyone at risk, but as my medic did say, it's been over the 14-day mark, so I can't possibly have it still. I have been recovered from it.
I want to comment on that because this actually, at least from my experience, and that's what I was mentioning earlier, that's a lie because I have two people that had COVID. They went in quarantine based on their math. They were released from COVID, and a lot of jobs are requesting that you bring a negative. My first friend got tested, and then she was still positive when she was let go of the. So she self-quarantined because she knew she still had the virus. It took another 4 days for her to like get a negative. So you can still have the virus, and their math doesn't add up. My brother finally, he spent 25 days with the virus because he was responsible according to the guidelines. He kept getting tested and he kept getting negative. So 10 days ago, they told him that he was safe to go back to work, but he still had the virus. So a lot of their models of, you know, this presumption that you don't have the virus is not correct, at least from my experience. And so like, I talked to a friend who's a medical professional, same thing. There's people that can have it, you know, multiple weeks. And so
are we talking about being contagious? Because my understanding is you'll still have not the virus, but like rather you'll have the antigens of having had it, but not contagious, right?
Then that brings up the question because my sister-in-law, she never showed symptoms at all, mm-hmm. you know, and she could have gone just like you, and she had a test done once. Mm-hmm. And that first test came back positive. She could have gone through her life and not even noticed that she had it. and it is very highly likely that she gave it to my brother.
Yeah.
And we don't know at what period or what point. We don't know how long she had it for. So there is a lot of unknowns. And,
yeah.
But even then, like, I feel your stigma. We in the house, we were really, like, looking at my brother, you know, being really scared of him. And at one point, we were like, listen, if you're wearing a mask, we're wearing a mask, it's fine. So we were interacting in the house. We did take a lot of precautions. But even at work, my bosses have insinuated that because his wife is working at a place that doesn't take the precautions that we do, mm-hmm. He insinuated that he doesn't feel safe that he goes back to work because of someone else. Mm. So, you know, this has a lot of repercussions, you know, this fear of people and policing people. And like you said, like, if you don't have symptoms, if you're wearing a mask, at least that's my rationale, you know, but they all doctors, even Kaiser Permanente, when we talked to my mother wasn't home 21 days. She never tested positive just because she was associated to someone with the virus. She was sent home 21 days. And the doctor, Kaiser Permanente doctor, deflected to the city officials who don't know what the hell they're doing. And a lot of the people that we interacted with, they were new, and they themselves are just following instructions from the top, the above. We were asking for a letter for my mother saying that she could go back to work because she tested negative. And the city would not provide that. And the people we were talking to from the city said that they don't understand why they're not giving letters, but that's the directive from the top. They're not releasing people to go back to work. And then my other friend who was in Contra Costa County, she was released after, you know, completing the 14 days. And they gave her a letter saying that she had tested negative. And that was a lie. The nurse said, you know, just in case you need it for housing. And that was a lie. So there's a lot of holes, a lot of things. Like, we don't really know. You know, that's been my experience. It can be one, you know, one off. But, you know, I've talked to some medical professional, like, friends. And they also, there's a lot of big gaps of, you know, of knowledge here. And they're even, like, they don't even believe the CDC anymore.
That's interesting, Kenny. Thank you for sharing. I had also read an article on NPR that testing can be works, not work. Sometimes they don't have very accurate test results. So who knows?
When my brother, before he was cleared, he got an inconclusive test too. So we've had the full range of experience with this thing, and it brings up a lot of questions, to be honest.
I guess the thing I would say is what this says to me is I feel that if you just looked at the mainstream media and you looked at Governor Newsom, the CDC, California, you'd think, and the way they're talking about the new rounds of infections, you'd think that, you know, the whole thing, like, you'd think they were taking very seriously a health threat. And they were like, you know, we're doing everything to keep you safe and we're going to keep you all locked down and stuff like that. But I feel like when you look at how the actual people who are involved in the work are dealing with it, I do feel like there's a kind of informality that comes from their own experience of being like, how serious is this? And it seems like there's like the people who are actually doing the work don't, I think they see that there's something that's not quite right about the way that this is being spelled out. Like there's this mass, this hysteria that's being driven through us. That's how I see it, at least. Because they're like the idea that you would, if everyone thought this was so dangerous, then you would give somebody something so they could get housing. I mean, it just tells me that those health workers are like, we've been dealing with this. This isn't as bad as what Newsom and all them are saying, but we can't really say anything. We got to keep it on the down low. That's how it looks to me.
And, you know, even again, they're spending a lot of money on this. That's where I look at. Some people are raking it in. You know, like one of my family members was sent to a hotel. They got food and it was shitty. They got sent to a hotel with mold. There was mold in the fucking, you know, in the bathtub. And they didn't tell us anything because they didn't want to worry us, because that was the only option for all of us to quarantine safely, separate from each other. But, you know, someone's making money out of this. You know, you think those little meals. I want to see the bills after all this is done. And no one's asking questions right now, because we're just supposed to take their word for it.
No question. There's CARES money going to hospitals, and that are saying they have a number of cases. So there's no question. We're talking about tens, maybe even hundreds of billions of dollars federally being distributed for COVID, for the effects of COVID.
Yeah. But there's so many things that don't add up. You know, we had an episode on this, even the way people are being categorized, deaths, you know, those are highly questionable. They made a decision at the beginning of all this to, you know, basically not, you know, do due diligence to find out whether someone actually died from COVID or something else. But if it's suspicion of COVID, it counts as a death of COVID. And especially when, like, the cases, the more, you know, we know, I think that we all kind of know that the numbers are way higher, you know, infection. You know, again, like my sister-in-law and a lot of people could have gone with no symptoms and had the virus. And so, and if you increase the cases and if you decrease the number of deaths, you know, that are categorized as COVID-related, and even now with the numbers they give us, like we're at 3.3 like death rate. And I know this is controversial for people, you know, people are dying, you know, no doubt. But I think we are fixated on death and, you know, in every, like, a, you know, what do you call those things? Like a droplet thing. Every death is magnified and focused and zeroed in. And of course the world looks very dangerous from that perspective.
I'm going to take a test tomorrow. I'll share with you both my results. Let's see. I know that the stigmatization of it, definitely. Friends that were meeting up with me 2 meters apart, you know, walking together, just suddenly don't want to meet up anymore. So, anyhow, well, that's interesting. I thank you. I guess right. We'll segue right into. Before that, there was a thought. There it is. I too have been opened my eyes with our episodes and with John Kleisig and with Alison, and really, I sent you both a text message where I think I have a position on in the discourse of reopening schools. I have really been impacted by our several of the conversations we've had, but I do ultimately think that there will be more consequences that outweigh the consequences of not going back to school for children. And so I say that cautionary in a way that careful, because I know that there's a lot of sensitivity about it, but I think it's important to begin having the conversation, and we shouldn't be judgy of others. Because of the positions that we are taking. So I do think that is where the most growth I have experienced out of the episodes in the summer.
Last I want to say is, like, I'm still going to wear a mask. I still wear a mask, you know, and whatever, you know, like, I still take precautions. I'm not saying, like, don't, you know, we should even, like, probably when the flu is around anyway. So, but we all go to work, but whatever. So do wear a mask, clean your hands, do those things.
But the fact is that this story and the discussions of death rates and numbers of infections, state counting, the discussion of opening schools and are you going to do it distance, which is important, but it has essentially knocked almost everything except for the elections and Kamala Harris and all that stuff. It has knocked out everything off of people's radar. There's very little talk of what's happened with the economy, of what has happened for the wealthy in this country, of what's happening to small businesses and what's happening in our cities right now as things are just being eroded. That discussion is off the table because we all must bow down to the infection count. And that is intentional. They know that this infection count is not what's driving whatever they're doing, like the capitalist class, I'm gonna say. And they know that they're paying attention to other stuff, but they wanna keep our eyes on that. Because the kinds of changes they are making in the economy right now are setting the stage for the kind of the economic uprooting that I think you more associate with war, where whole sectors are flattened, and they have to be reconstructed, but they're only reconstructed by the people who have the capital. And that's what was we talked about last time when we talked about the stimulus package and the 500 billion that was going to be turned into 4.5 trillion. That was all money to buy up distressed assets. And we are just seeing the beginning of the distress, let alone unemployment and things like that. So this story has been a story to keep us distracted from the story that we should have been paying attention to.
Why don't we then discuss the announcement of Joe Biden this week then? Because they're going to fix the economy.
Eduardo,
we have issues.
Eduardo starts off strong.
Go ahead. Anyone excited for Kamala Harris and Joe Biden? First woman of color.
Would you start? I'd like to hear what you think about it. And we talked about we're going to keep this down like low, but I'd like to hear what you think about this announcement.
Well, I can't deny that I felt a little excitement, not because I'm going to vote for her, because I'm not, or for them, but because I'll take you back in 2003 or 2002, it was when she was running for district attorney here in San Francisco. I was in the country, and I was here in San Francisco in neighborhood West Portal in Goodwill with my mother, and she was campaigning. And she stopped by and she walked in, and we were like five people in the Goodwill shop, and she came right at me and she shook my hand. So I guess that's what makes me excited, that I shook the hand of the vice president nominee.
who in 2 years will be president.
was that before or after she sent letters with her police badge to parents in the San Francisco school district?
I think before. Anyhow, that's my interaction with Kamala Harris. I met her a long, long time ago. What is my reaction? I suppose I just said it. I'm not voting for Joe Biden or Kamala Harris. They're not the ideal candidate I would vote for. I know that both of you don't vote or just want to vote for any Democrats. I sometimes have decided that I will for candidates, but most likely not. Most likely for propositions and a few candidates here and there. But I don't see how Kamala Harris went after Joe Biden for his record, and then it's just a little fake. You know, just here we are getting along. Like racism that you have supported is just wiped away. So that's my take on it.
Honestly, I clapped. It was masterful what the Democrats did. You know, we went from, you know, Bernie being a leader, you know, leading candidate, you know, a lot of liberal Democrats wanted to, you know, at least reluctantly, some people were reluctantly behind Bernie, whatever, but we went from that to him being out of the race. Remember we had that episode where we predicted who was going to be the candidate? You said Joe Biden. Look, your candidate has.
You know, man. You're right.
And so in that, before this happened, you know, before the nomination, Black Lives Matter has, you know, taken the attention of, you know, until the last few weeks, actually, it has died down on the news. There's still battles happening, obviously, intense battles, but they're not being covered. And so this is a middle finger to that. You know, Kamala Harris is a middle finger to, you know, Black Lives Matter, who were, you know, motivated by the police and brutality, or, you know, defunding police. And here is, you know, a candidate that is pro, you know, pro all that shit. And, you know, yeah, to me, it's like symbolic. This is the Democrats saying, this is how we're going to rule. You know, and it's funny that people want to argue that Trump is the maximum expression of fascism. Well, pick your stick. You know, she loves to talk about, you know, the big stick, you know, to get people in line. And here it is, pick your red stick or your blue stick.
I wanted to find out what the Wall Street Journal was going to say about this pick. And here was the headline of one of their latest articles. So this is Wall Street Journal. As Kamala Harris joins Biden ticket, Wall Street sighs in relief. Wall Street warm welcome to Joe Biden's running mate reflects a belief that tougher financial regulation isn't a top priority. They go on to say more about this, but this is a clear indication that the establishment that lost in 2016, the Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, but that establishment has resurfaced and is looking to take power. And it's looking to use, so I would not call, what Kenny, what you said about Black, this is a middle finger to Black Lives Matter. No, I would, well, Black Lives Matter is as a movement that with the face, the name of it, not the sentiment that exists underneath, which I do think is about people being disgusted by racism and wanting to do something about prisons and things like and police and the racism that they see in our society. So the sentiment from the bottom, which I'm not willing to call Black Lives Matter, because I think Black Lives Matter is a Democratic Party label. And I think that Kamala Harris is the culmination of that movement. This is what that movement has now accomplished. This is why there's no real discussion about what's going on in Chicago right now as they shut down the city and a kid was not killed, but he's in stable condition. And Democratic mayors are now joining up with Trump to sick the federal dogs on the people of Chicago. The thing that everyone was complaining about Portland, which no, like when Trump did it and sent all those federal troops out there, and without saying that the powers to do that were one, he was given the money to do that with Homeland Security by the Democratic Party, and Barack Obama was the one who passed the laws that gave him a blank check to do such an act. And now you see a Chicago mayor joining up with Trump to get law and order back in Chicago after shooting another black individual. So this is the tragedy, again, of the Democratic Party collecting your movement, like all, got to catch them all. They got to, like every Pokemon on the board. And then this is what it accomplishes. It gets an establishment figure who's essentially politically the equivalent of Hillary Clinton, but she's a person of color. And that is supposed to be, here's your racial identity card to show you that we will give you representation, but what we will do is give you a middle finger in terms of anything you want, because we plan on dividing rich and poor more. We are about putting more police, which is both Joe Biden and Kamala Harris were both about. And furthermore, I think it raises an interesting question, because people have been saying, what the hell is they picking a California governor? It doesn't get him any votes. I mean, a California district attorney, it doesn't get, they are getting the state. Biden's going to win California's, you know, it doesn't get any votes, but that's not what it's about. It's not, this pick shows that they don't care anything about votes. They already understand they have the entire progressive vote, first of all, but the votes that they are worried about are the Wall Street votes, essentially the capitalist votes. This is the money they're trying to attract with Kamala Harris. This is about fundraising. And that's why they want Kamala Harris, because she's connected to Clinton's. She's connected to all that network. And that's what they're trying to do with Kamala Harris' choice. It is about reaching deep into the pockets of the capitalist class and saying, we are your people. We will govern responsibly. We will bring back the order of the old order. And we can talk a little bit about what would be the difference between a Biden, Kamala Harris presidency versus Trump's, because there will be some differences. But in terms of what's going to happen to the working class in this country, and what's going to happen in terms of the level of surveillance and the level of, cracking down on protests, absolutely no difference. In fact, the Democrats will be worse. That's been their history. They'll likely be worse, and they'll have more cover for getting worse, like you see with Lori Lightfoot in Chicago.
Yeah.
So it should be seen as a middle finger to the Black Lives Matter, but Black Lives Matter and all the people who are part of that apparatus, just like our unions are part of that apparatus, they're not going to say a thing. They're all going to say we did this, but it's actually very, very bad for the workers in this country. It's very, very bad for Black workers in this country. Like Kamala Harris could be vice president. Likely, if they win, she'll be president in a year or two, because there's no way Joe Biden's going to last. But it's tragic, almost comic. But it's I wasn't surprised, but to see them do it is sort of striking how confident they are that they can say F you to any progressive, and the progressives will take it. That's the thing. The progressives, Bob Avakian, Revolutionary Communist Party, is saying he'll vote for Biden because he's not Trump. He's not Trump. He's worse in some ways. And they might be worse. And there's going to be less opposition to them when they do their nonsense. So it's horrible.
And obviously, you know, weaponizing, criticizing Kamala Harris with all her labels, whatever, you know, because she went from being black to being biracial now, even in some of the articles that's describing her. Point being is that she's, you know, criticizing her will be, you know, they're going to use identity politics to criticize us who are criticizing her because she's black and she's a woman. And, you know, but to me, like, yes, you know, either way we're screwed. Locally, at least, is going to sort out through the people that are willing to see this as a middle finger and the people that are seeing, you know, just biting the same bait as always. You know, because I do agree that the majority of people are not going to see it as a middle finger. And I mean, people like, you know, Sean King, he is completely behind. You should see his the way he completely mangle his support for Kamala Harris, calling it a historical moment, you know, for people of color, basically, and completely dismissing, you know, their actually her body of work and, you know, and what she actually represents.
I have long let go of being excited for someone of color to represent the people of, you know, community of color, or having a woman in office, because as we have seen historically, you know, if you are a Democrat, a corporate Democrat, if you are a capitalist, if you are someone in a position of power, you're that in this system, that we aren't going to see what we expect to see from them, that they will somehow look out for our interests. Democrats aren't, I mean, if my friends are wondering, when I share this, why am I not voting for Joe Biden, that I then becoming more of a Trump supporter by default. I recently had conversations with Andy that I've been struggling in these liberal circles with friends that are toasty white liberals that love this very softy liberals that I have been hanging out with. It. They have attacked me in many ways, thinking that I am by default a Trump supporter. I'm definitely not. And then here I come into this other circle where I'm seen as another, as just a liberal by these two. But I tell them that Joe Biden voted for the war in the Middle East, the war in Iraq, in Afghanistan, mass incarceration, you know, not necessarily for universal healthcare in the way that Bernie Sanders had wanted it, or even if we look at some of his track record in his camaraderie with past white supremacists and the way that he handled an Anita Hill Supreme Court. It was a hearing on Anita Hill and the way that he treated her. And we look at Dr. Christine Ford, and we now look at Anita Hill, and same thing has happened. And at that time, it was Joe Biden who was leading that hearing. I mean, I don't understand how anybody in the liberal circles I'm speaking to would make me feel guilty. I think they should look at his track record. And they should also see some of what Kenya has been talking about with Kamala Harris and her track record as well. She hasn't always been very anti-police. She isn't very progressive. So I think that it's ingenuous when people try to attack, I think, us when they say that, you know, why aren't you voting for the better of two evils? Going back to that frame of thinking, we should just look at people's track record. I don't want any of these two. So that is that. And And I feel for the people in the Middle East who have had now, what, 19 years of our invasion, even past other wars that we've been in. But recently we've just hit 19 years this is the year of the 19 years of being in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so I'm really disheartened, and especially after what's happened with the explosion in Beirut and Lebanon, all of that proxy wars in that area and with Saudi Arabia in Yemen, it's not helping the situation with their, you know, unstable governments that are largely due to the destabilization of those governments because of meddling the U.S. imperialistic hands in those cookie jars, no? And then we have recently the CIA or the intelligence, and I'll just say this intelligence apparatus trying to warn Trump about Russian bonds, no? And I, as we have covered already in one of the episodes, where we have seen that the intelligence community is really in disagreement with the Trump administration, Trump himself a lot of times, and are looking forward to more of a presidency that would be in more cahoots with them. So I just don't see how, I see the intelligence as being another force, and Wall Street, another force to bring in a Democrat. And I could possibly see a Democrat winning because of all these reasons. I think it would benefit Wall Street and it would benefit the intelligence community as they're trying hard to topple Trump off. Because it's not, he is in some ways sort of different in that sense. He's doing it his way with how he wants to stay out of other people's countries and not so-called be the police state.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you bring up, Eduardo, yeah, I agree. I agree with that. I think it is worth spelling out that Kamala Harris was pleased with herself for putting people in jail for marijuana possession offenses, pleased with herself for threatening parents whose kids weren't going to school to put them in jail and to fine them. And she was, I mean, I don't think she bragged necessarily about it, but she was exposed for basically saying there are people who should be coming out of a prison system, but they're putting out fires, saving California. So we're going to keep them in prison, even though they should be coming out of prison, because she wanted to use that prison for cheap labor and for what California needed, but sacrifice their lives, even though, you know, these people shouldn't have been in prison and shouldn't be working there anymore. So she is pro-prisons, pro-prison industrial complex. And for that reason, she is an enemy of black workers, even though she's, you know, a person of color. What's interesting to me as to what is going on with the fight at the top, because in terms of this country, and I do think it seems that Trump has been able to convince the entire ruling class that China needs to be taken on. If we have to remember, under Clinton in 2016, that was the period of Trans-Pacific Partnership, where the U.S. ruling class was still trying to, you know, bring China in while defeat China in an economic competition, but be heavy on Russia militarily, but not so much with China. And Trump said, no, we can't do that anymore. We have to take them seriously. And I think he's won that argument within the establishment as a result of his presidency and through his presidency. And I think Biden, Kamala Harris have already promised that they're to the right on Trump, actually, on some of this, basically saying, he's not tough enough on China. We're going to get tough on China when we're in office. The big difference, well, I don't know if it's a big difference, but one of the differences I see is Trump basically said, I don't want to have to deal with NATO anymore. We're going to go it alone. We're going to make bilateral agreements. And I do see that Biden and Harris seem to want to rebuild the NATO alliance largely as a counterweight to China. But they also still, and this gets to a story I think, Eduardo, you had mentioned earlier, not in this episode, but talk with me about, was all that stuff was coming out about like Russia hiring Taliban to kill U.S. soldiers only a few months ago. All that turned out to be a lie. But that is the CIA, that is the establishment, very much trying to build a story about we have to continue to essentially fight two wars at once, China and Russia. And I think That's not Trump's strategy. That is Joe Biden and Kamala Harris' strategy. They have promised to get tough on Russia much more so, and that, and have criticized Trump for what, obviously for being a Russian stooge, but at the very least being weak on Russia. And they promise to not do that. So you have a president who, or these potential president, Kamala Harris and Biden, who have basically promised to go after two largely militarized powers simultaneously. And it's clear to me that, to me, they're more dangerous even than Trump. Which strategy will work? That's something the ruling class is trying to figure out. And that's how, that's a part of the debate that I see taking place here. That obviously we as workers have no stake in any of this. So that's one thing that I'm trying to make sense of, is what is the actual difference here that matters to the ruling class in this country?
From my perspective, you know, like, I'm curious as to what this means. Obviously, my niche is almost the immigration issue. You know, obviously, I'm a socialist, and like, I try to look at all the things in connection. But, you know, here people think that, you know, a Democratic, on this topic, right, immigration, a Democratic candidate or government is going to release the pressure on immigrants. But here you have a tough on crime duo, you know, and, you know, I just see more depictions of immigrants as, you know, criminals and persecution, you know, especially in the context of a shrinking economy, you know, that, you know, they're going to have to scapegoat someone. And obviously the most vulnerable are people that don't vote or, you know, don't have a say at all. So I'm really concerned, you know. I think in past episodes we've said, you know, like, that reformism leads to fascism, and people don't see that in this moment. But I actually fear that, you know, I didn't know how it's going to come, but it will, you know, and it's just a matter of, you know, which color, you know, you want to choose. You know, ultimately, to me, it doesn't matter who stays in office. We're going to have to do the work on the ground, you know, to fight back, to resist, to try to organize, to try to understand these things. But definitely, if we fall for the bait that they're giving us again, you know, and people are chewing that bait, you know, half-heartedly, but they still have this unwillingness to let go and deconstruct their frame of analysis. So, it, you know, I'm not so optimistic as to that, you know, that this moment is going to be, you know, I'm actually concerned that it's going to kill some of the feistiness, you know, if there is any, you know, on the left. You know, it's going to demoralize people. And, you know, we'll see. But I'm also at the same time, I'm curious, like I said, locally, to see who's really about, you know, the fight, you know, because, you know, the people that are casual allies or casual, you know, whatever, you know, they're going to fall asleep. And so I want to see who's really in it for the long run, at least in my circles. And, you know, people are, at least in my circles, again, people are starting to ask questions and see, you know, things differently. We are very far from doing anything significant, but obviously starts from understanding some things differently. And just following that carrot again is not, it's actually leading us to a cliff. And I don't know, I'm concerned.
I was reading something about how most people identify themselves as independents, not necessarily Democrats or Republicans. And I think that there is something there. Or even the Black Lives Matter, the people who go, I'm not talking about the people who are leading Black Lives Matter movements. I'm talking about the people who are excited, pumped, who want to do something, and they think that this is a vehicle, so they go and hop onto it, no? But as you both have pointed out, when you went to the, what was it, the Mission High School Black Lives Matter event, yeah, you saw that the people who were talking there were mostly about voting for Joe Biden, or voting out, rather, Trump, yeah. Really anti-Trump sentiment, or at least the people who are really leading the manifestaciones. But I think that this is a moment where we need to, I mean, I'm thinking about the environment constantly. So I'm where time is ticking, and I'm hoping something does happen, as we are seeing in our brothers and sisters in Lebanon. And they are upset, rightly so. They have been upset. And with the Beirut explosion, they're even more upset for the carelessness. And I hope that we see that. I think we have seen some uprisings. What was it, June? Late June, right? Early July?
George Floyd.
That was June, yeah.
Yeah.
I think we need to really, I'm speaking to the audience now. We need to find our places to prepare for, to really think outside of just voting. How do I say this one? I just wish liberals would be able to allow those spaces too, because I understand why people sometimes get trapped into thinking outside the box when they might be attacked for it. I wanted to say more of just thinking of friends in the moment, but that's it. I'll just say that for now. There's a lot that happened over the summer, and I'm also concerned about the unemployment and the millions of US Americans losing their homes over the summer because of rent. And here we are. It's like people don't have a way to think about politics or larger issues because they're worrying about survival, which is completely understandable. But this pandemic, as you have both finally convinced me of, is a political game. It is used to mostly distract people. And I do think, I want us to be clear, I do think this is real. This isn't a hoax, but it isn't. It's been used to in a way to be able to distract people from focusing on larger issues. We have a greater pandemic, and it's making people just lose focus.
And
that's all.
And the other real thing that is also a hoax is the U.S. elections. It's going
other
to
hoax or I wasn't calling.
Yeah, no, COVID-19 I would call the U.S. A elections a hoax because it's a hoax yeah. because there's nothing. First of all, there's nothing to choose from if the election isn't just rigged as it is. Department of Homeland Security now controls all the election apparatus. So I actually believe that they already know that. I don't even think either party is worried about votes at this point. I think they're worried about who's going to raise the money and who's going to get the green light from the capitalist class to say you are the ones who will rule. Because I think they can gin the votes up any way they want to make what happens. So, yeah, I actually believe our own elections are better understood as an actual hoax. But that's the second hoax that they want to keep people because now people are wondering which party is going to keep the unemployment for us. Which party is going to might be Trump. He did an executive order, $400, but 100 has to be paid by the states, but not all states. If Trump probably wants to put the hammer on some states and make them pay and other states that he's friendly to, he can give them the full $400. You know, and then the Democrats are trying to play ball with this thing. So basically the working class is again playing the role of a spectator while their house is on fire. And that's what the election has provided as well as the virus. But the election is the regular one. The election is every 4 years, 2 years, they get to play this game that says we're giving you choices when all that's really happening is the noose is getting tighter and tighter on the class. The other thing that I want to talk about what Kenny was saying about immigration. Like, look, as a school that serves a large population of immigrants, and either some of the students might have issues with regards to documentation, or they have family with regards to documentation. Well, now everyone is in some sort of social security data network that says you got a Chromebook, we know when you logged on, we know what you're doing here. If you don't log on and you have too many absences, we're going to come and find you. We're going to come and see what's going on. We're going to do a wellness check. Do you know what a wellness check means for a family that has somebody who's undocumented? That means the state's going to come in and find out somebody's undocumented and they're deporting you. This apparatus, as I already said it before, this is the apparatus of the Democratic Party. This data collection, surveillance, we've got to contact trace everyone. This is Democrats. So everyone's running away from Trump because he's a fascist, but we are literally building a surveillance state apparatus that makes our schools right now, currently very dangerous for any immigrant student to log on into. or you better show up and not give us any reason to believe that we are going to do a family check on you. Because who's going to do that family check? What are they going to see when they get there? And who's going to do that? So this is going to be a very dangerous time for immigrant families. And right in the school system, because I'm not even saying whether it's a student who has documentation. If that student has an uncle, that's how this stuff uncorks when people do wellness checks in these houses or in these families.
ICE calls them collaterals. You know, people that, you know, they come, they say that they're looking for someone, but then they start asking questions and, you know, do you have papers?
Right.
And then they're collaterals. And
so,
And they have quota they have to meet and whatever. But.
So it's just, people have to understand all this data collection, data mining, contract tracing stuff is very, very dangerous for somebody where that the state knows is not legit. You know, it's dangerous for all of us who are legit, actually. I mean, obviously, but it's very dangerous for those people. So things are by definition going to get worse because this stuff is brought to you by, like, it was Governor Cuomo talking about reimagining schools with Bill Gates and Eric Schmidt, who's from the Alphabet company, right? So that's the Democratic Party, all right, bringing that stuff. I do want to say one thing about, as cynical as it is that the upper echelon of the Black Lives Matter has literally sold their cause to get Kamala Harris anointed vice president, I do still understand, this is from my conversations with my brother and conversations with people who have, there has been an awareness and a bit of an awakening around racism as it plays out for people. Like, I do think it's opened up areas where people are having conversations at the base of society that maybe didn't happen before. And that is promising. And one group that I'm really paying attention to, and I don't know if people heard about it, but they're called the Not Fucking Around Coalition. Have you all heard about that?
It's a militia in Georgia, right?
Yeah, oh, well, it's described as a paramilitary organization in the United States. I don't know where it's centered. Because they've gotten together, they went in Georgia and marched, and they went in Kentucky and marched. But it's a paramilitary organization in the United States. It has been described as a black militia. It has been linked to the new, this is from Wikipedia, but new Black Panther Party. But they deny any connection to the Black Panther Party or Black Lives Matter. But here's what the John J. Fitzgerald Johnson, known as Grandmaster J, who claims leadership of the group, he said this. We are a black militia. We aren't protesters. We aren't demonstrators. We don't come to sing. We don't come to chant. That's not what we do. Basically, this to me looks like an independent group. And if they stay independent, if they don't become silent during this elections or kind of off the you know, to the side, vote for Biden and Kamala Harris, to me, this kind of group does speak to a potential hope of something independent, something serious, and something that the U.S. state will have to pay attention to, and hopefully that our movement can mirror both in its independence and its willingness to arm itself in the face of an increasingly dangerous state. So that, to me, is kind of the hope for the future.
I think this is where I'll insert Portland. I think it's a little scary for people when you have the U.S. state coming up in furgonetas, vans, and hauling people into them, disappearing with them, and then charging them, or sometimes not charging them, but just scare tactics, and without any identifiable IDs, it just Gestapo sort of, you know, stuff that I would think happened mostly in countries where Kenya and I are from, where Latin America, and what used to happen in Italy, and as well as Germany. Well, of course, it could have happened during Franco and also Mussolini, but I'm just saying, most I was thinking Hitler, where you had the feds going into basically kidnapping people. I think that it is necessary now to defend ourselves. I'm still treading carefully around that because I have difficulties around sort of violent acts, as you both know. But and as one of our gun control episodes, I invite people to check out on the link below that Andy will put there. But I do think that we have to find a way. I mean, if you look at Hong Kong, I mean, people are the people who are really upset, not people who are being used as pawns. They're being snatched by the government as well as this government is now doing. So we criticize China for doing what they're doing. This very government is doing that. So I don't know if I want to say I welcome that sort of militia, but I will say that I think it's important that we start looking at different ways to protect ourselves instead of depending on the government through some court system that is flawed and will ultimately just give us a big multa, like fine, and will imprison us. I was reading somewhere that in some state here in the USA, some protesters were charged with life imprisonment.
Yeah. And again, just to tie back to Kamala Harris and Biden, I think that's where they're going to come in and say, you know, like, enough with your protests. You know, enough with the get in line, you know, we give you what you wanted, basically, or whatever, pretend, and then approach criminals and, you know, advance the narrative and persecute people. You know, this isn't over. You know, this is just starting. And I don't know. I mean, we'll see what level of resistance we'll get, you know, once they're, if and when they're in office. But at the same time, it's like, I'm not surprised. Like, fascism or these neo-fascist things, they happen. It's just, they're not in our face. You know, they happen in poor communities, you know, that are over-policed. And, you know, it's just, it's just in the news, you know, or it was, because it's no longer. And even the most nasty police repression did not make it to the news, you know, to the mainstream news. A lot of these images, these things that I saw when we were going through the struggle in Nicaragua, you know, when I was waking up with fucking nightmares because I was watching too much violence, this shit is happening here in your backyard. It's still happening today. You know, and it happened with Obama. How do you think Obama and that administration dismantled the Occupy movement? It wasn't with flowers and, you know, and fucking donuts, whatever. Cops did eat donuts. But you know, again, this shit happens all the time. You know, it's just that the liberal media wants to politicize it for obvious reasons to make it seem that, like, it's Trump. But the fucking majors, like Lori Lightfoot in Chicago, you know, they're complicit. Fucking our own mayor in this city, you know, a black woman, London Breed, she threatened us with the fucking, you know, the National Guard, you know, because people approached her house, you know, and they were protesting at her house. She really got scared, you know. So the Democrats have shown how they're going to rule.
You're talking about the mayor of San Francisco.
London Breed, yeah, the mayor, yeah. So, yeah, it's not going to get better. You know, it's not. And you know, if anything, the fight is going to get harder for those who stick around and want to continue to fight.
Yeah, and just to say that the demobilization of the movements is not something for the future. In Portland, the NAACP, when things were really going down in Portland, the NAACP really came out and lectured the protesters to be like, get serious. You know, we have work to do to deal with Trump. So they were already telling people, like, you know, stop.
So I think as the election day nears, we'll be hearing more of hacking from Russia. And so I'm just wondering, maybe we'll do an episode. I'm curious where Kenny stands. The last time we talked about this briefly in one of the episodes that was not about hacking, Kenny said something that threw me off. I wasn't sure. I thought he was going to side completely with you. And I'm not saying he's siding with me. I'm just saying he gave me a little piece of, like, okay, fine. There might be some troll farming, but it's nothing to do with the election. So I'm curious where he stands on that. But as we approach it, maybe we'll talk about that in the future. And since we didn't get a chance to talk about it during this episode, but any final thoughts anyone else has on some of the stuff that we've talked about or something that we should cover about the summer of 2020? Very, again, as I said, a pivotal year, vice presidential nominee, Black Lives Matter, evictions, pandemia, Portland, George Floyd, everything. Anyone?
I've been thinking about some of the things you said, Kenny, about people going, like, you know, some people around me are like feeling like the Democratic Party is giving them the middle finger. I think that's definitely the case. The thing that dismays me is how many of those people who feel like they're getting the middle finger, really, truly feel like they're getting the middle finger of the Democratic Party, but are going to eat that middle finger and swallow it and vote anyway. There is something deadening about that act. When the capitalist class gives you a middle finger right to your face and you vote for them and you say, okay, I want you, there is a killing thing that happens. I mean, it can be undone later down the road, but that has been the situation of the left for quite some time. And it has never, in my mind, it has never, the ruling class, the capitalist class, has never been able to give as clear a middle finger to the entire left, from the revolutionary wing to the independent wing of the left to the diehard Democrats, and to a person, all of them, I feel like, are accepting some version of that middle finger and gonna go with the Democrats. Or at the very least say, Trump's a fascist and Biden isn't, which to me is basically a way of saying, vote for Biden. That is really dismaying to me that that's going to happen. It's not about will you vote or do you not vote. It is about how much shit people are willing to eat and then say, thank you, give me another. That is not a situation the working class can tolerate if it's going to be a fighting working class. So my hope is there's going to be more not fucking around coalitions formed. Black, white, Latino, multiracial, but armed, serious. Hopefully these folks are serious and prepared to do what it takes to take back their lives, their jobs, their communities, and prepared to challenge the state over who's really controlling this world.
I don't know. I guess for me, you know, I think we need to get used to hearing austerity. you know, it's gonna come down our throats, and it's kind of crazy that a lot of people don't even know what the hell austerity means. You know, the educated class around me, at least, quote unquote. But yeah, it's coming. You know, something that didn't come up here is that, you know, San Francisco is planning to cut up to 40 bus lines out of the 69 that they had before COVID. So that is the war on the working people, you know, and no one's, you know, there is no noise about it. We're just taking it. And that's just symbolic of what's coming, you know, and the battle lines are going to be drawn. You know, I don't know who's going to stick around, you know, who's going to have the fortitude, you know, the emotional, political, whatever, you know, but I'm looking forward to finding those people that will stick around, that will stand on their feet and say, fuck this shit. You know, I did some of my, you know, colleagues that do go to the protests and they're very active, militant. They've hurt kids, you know, and again, kids, whatever, but they've hurt some kids where some people, some liberal ideas, you know, don't touch the black businesses. Some kids who are saying, fuck black capitalists. You know, and we're going to need more of that shit, you know, to stop biting the bait of, you know, identity politics. You know, I don't give a shit, you know, for a black, brown woman capitalist, you know, away with this system. And, you know, that's my message. And that's my North Star. And it has to be the North Star of many more people. And I'm hoping, you know, more people join, but we'll see. I know it's not going to be, we're far from anything significant, but I do believe that as a socialist, a revolutionary, you have to be hopeful. There is hope in there because you expect better. If you don't expect better, then fucking, like, you know, lay down and die. And so I expect better, and I'll keep fighting, and hopefully other people join.
Well, I mean, I think that in every election year, we have to tackle and renew the conversation of why voting for the better of two evils. Is that the expression? The better of two
evils? The lesser of two evils, but it's the same.
But what is it?
I like yours better. I like better of two evils than lesser of two evils.
Oh, the lesser of two evils. Yeah. all these idioms, all of these expressions, I know them and I hear them, but it's like when I was telling Gemma, when she put something about coming to age, I said it's coming of age, not coming to age. Right. So sometimes I know. Anyhow, the lesser of two evils, I think we need to have this conversation every election year, because people are so caught up in the politics of the election year. So I hope that we will have this conversation as election day comes, that we need to sort of round up folks to convince them that this is actually, I will acknowledge that the voting is a hoax. It's not necessarily a direct vote. And I appreciate this conversation because it allows me to really stick to my positions as I navigate the liberal spaces, and I'm attacked constantly for being a default Trump supporter.
Yeah, which welcome to the party.
Eduardo Trump support. Come on,
man. I know, right? Me? Well, that's what I was told at least a week and a half ago. So anyhow, we'll have more conversations about this, and hopefully people will listen still to us. You know, I will say what I meant to say earlier, when people will still listen to us, they're still listening. I'm just saying we have a small audience. That's what I meant to say. I will say to both of you, I'm not sure if we want to include this, but it's very important that we don't lose our focus, as Kenny, I think you were saying, did you say as a focus, Kenny? Oh, you're North Star, you said North Star, because our conversations really do bring very provocative thought to some people. At least I know three people that listen regularly. I know we have a small audience, mm-hmm. but three people that I know personally that listen to these discussions and say that really struck something with me. What Kenny said made me think, or what Andy had said, I don't know if I agree with it, but it really makes me, oh, it was like violence in my head, you know, because it's very provocative. Or what I said, you know, can be sometimes, whatever it is, as I had later learned, AJ likes to disagree with me a lot, if you're listening to this, AJ. But it really is, it is sort of like these conversations, we must not lose sight of why we're doing this. And I appreciate these conversations because it's election year, and that's all that people are talking about in the mainstream media. If you look at just YouTube, the recommendations are just, at least on my YouTube, it's like, oh, Kamala Harris, no? Yeah. So that's it. All right, anything
else?
I
want to second what you said, Eduardo. I appreciate it. I said it earlier, but I'm really feeling it now. I'm just very grateful to be able to meet weekly with you both to let out some steam and try to figure out what the F is going on. And I very much appreciate the people who listen and criticize you or me or Kenny. That matters to me. I don't really care how large that group is. It's the fact that there's people who take the time to listen to it and think about what they think the world should really be like. That matters a lot to me.
Thank you, both of you. All right, that does it for this week's episode. Let's conclude. Before my nephew starts making lots of noise in the bathroom, that's just right there. That does it for this week's episode. What's Left is a weekly political podcast / channel challenging the mainstream left. We post information about our topics and our guests on the episode notes, where we found this episode on or on our blog at what-s-left.webno.com. You can find past episodes to this podcast / channel there and connect with us. I remind folks, if you like anything that you have heard here, please share your favorite episode, rate, review, and subscribe to any of our 6 platforms. Thank you, Andy. On Spotify, iTunes, Podcast, Stitcher, Google Play, BitChute, or YouTube. And if you would like to give us feedback about something you've heard or suggest something for us to cover, contact us through our blog. Andy Lipson will most likely be the one who will be contacted through there. Thank you, Andy, again. And I'm Eduardo Barca with co-host Andy Lipson and Kenny Cepeda. It's so great to see you again, Kenny. After a break. Oh, and I hope you heard my shout out to you in the last episode that we had with Tracy. Okay, good. Thank you.
You guys pushed me out, but it's fine.
That's me, Kenny. Hey, that's me.
We're going to edit that out. We're going to edit that out because it might be true.
I was there trying to log in as a show, and they didn't let me in. Max is it.
A big thank you to everyone that makes this show happen. Saludos to everyone, and see you all next time. Wash your hands, be safe. Ciao.